A wind farm lawsuit raises the question of eagle protection. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Flathead reporter Katrin Fry profiles retiring state fisheries manager Jim Vashrow. In our ongoing series on the Bakken, Capital reporter Dan Boyce takes us to a unique writing workshop. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with the Federal Ferret Recovery Coordinator about the challenges of reintroducing the black-footed ferret. A California utility is asking a federal judge to decide if the developers of a Northwest Montana wind farm did enough to protect nearby golden eagles. San Diego Gas and Electric claims in court documents that a subsidiary of Spanish wind power company Nature Enter misrepresented the risk of the birds being killed by the Rimrock wind farm near Cutbank. The utility is seeking to withdraw its pledge to invest $285 million in the project. Nature Enter USA spokesman Patrick Ferguson said today, no eagles have been hurt since the turbines began operating last year. The two sides filed lawsuits against one another in state courts last week, but the utility now says the case should be in U.S. District Court in Montana because it involves a federally protected species.
And in other news from around the state, a 39-year-old Whitefish woman charged with a felony assault with a weapon for a November 25th stabbing that critically injured her husband has been released from jail. The Daily Interlake reports District Judge Robert Allison reduced bond from $75,000 to $25,000 for Anne Marie Newton after a hearing last Friday. The Flathead County Attorney's Office said she posted bond on Monday. A Whitefish neighbor and a friend from Alaska both testified Friday that 37-year-old Chad Newton had previously injured his wife and had threatened to kill her and himself. Deputy County Attorney Travis Honor argued against a bond reduction, saying Anne Marie Newton initially said an intruder stabbed her husband. Honor said Chad Newton's father was seeking permission to make medical decision for his son, including removing him from life support.
The Bozeman Yellowstone International Airport is on track to be the state's busiest this year. Deputy Airport Director Scott Humphrey tells the Bozeman Daily Chronicle that the number of passengers flying into and out of Bozeman Yellowstone International totaled 812,093 through the end of November, while Billings Logan International saw 705,492 passengers during the same time period. Humphrey says passenger totals at the Bozeman Airport surpassed Billings over the summer. Numbers for December are not available yet. Humphrey attributes the increase in Bozeman passenger numbers to the addition of a direct flight to New York this year, as well as an additional Delta flight to Los Angeles on Saturdays. Humphrey said a daily direct flight to Atlanta was also added for the holiday season, while Billings lost Frontier Airlines.
Aquatic invasive species, bucket biology, lake trout suppression, public access, and family fishing are among the topics that have ruled Jim Vashrow's last 30 years with Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. Vashrow is retiring as the Region 1 Fisheries Manager for FWP with the end of this year. Oregon Region 1 includes Flathead Lake as well as numerous other lakes, rivers, and streams in northwest Montana. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry talks with Vashrow about a career spanning more than three decades and more than one contentious issue.
Jim Vashrow took the reins as the Region 1 Fisheries Manager for Fish, Wildlife, and Parks in Kalispell in 1981.
My timing wasn't very good. I got here just as the same year that MISA showed up and just before the Kokanee and Flathead Lake crashed. And, you know, in one way or another, that's colored most of the 31 years since. There has not been a single year or a single week in the last 31 years that I haven't heard about mysis and what a big mistake it was, and it was.
Vashrow says Flathead Lake was just one of more than 100 lakes that had mysis shrimp introduced, but arguably saw the most profound change.
The Flathead Lake of 1981 no longer exists. The ecology has been totally flipped upside down, and everything we're doing is treating symptoms. And until we really treat the problem, which is mysis, we're not going to get back to the old Flathead Lake.
During Vashrow's tenure, the state and the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes signed a co-management plan for Flathead Lake in 2000.
It was fairly groundbreaking. I don't think there's many other models like that across the nation for a tribe and an agency to come together. So that was a pretty neat thing. I hope we can eventually get back to that point.
The plan has since expired, and both sides have said they're interested in renewing a co-management agreement. The sticking point has been lake trout suppression. The tribes are prepping to move forward with more aggressive efforts, including netting. The state says this might do more harm than good right now. Illegally introduced fish, or bucket biology, is another issue Vacherot has been battling.
Fishermen need to recognize how much opportunity they've lost due to illegal introductions. Everybody will say, well, this one went, you know, this one produced a good fishery. For every one of those, I can show you 20 that, you know, we've lost opportunity and costs have gone up.
Vacherot gives Lake Mary Ronan as an example. The lake was a stronghold for kokanee salmon and a place where the state harvests kokanee salmon eggs for stocking operations. Vacherot says perch were illegally introduced, and 6 years later, they became the dominant fish in the lake.
We used to stock cutthroat. We gave that up. They don't survive. Rainbows used to be self-sustaining. They no longer make it. We have to stock them. We have to stock kokanee at a larger size to maintain a fishery, and all that's costing us maybe $40,000 a year more just to try to hold on to what we've got.
Vacherot says tracking illegal introductions has been a pet project, and he's developed a database that tracks them across the state.
The last update documented 500 illegal fish introductions in 250 waters. Unfortunately, half of those occurred here in Region 1 in northwest Montana, so we're seeing the brunt of that. I'm just in the process of updating that, and we're going to add nearly 100 more introductions in the last 7 years. It's a huge problem.
Restoring pure native Westlope cutthroat trout into the South Fork flathead drainage is an effort that sparked controversy when it was proposed, and Vacherot calls a success as it nears completion. More hybrid trout were starting to show up in this Westlope stronghold. The state has been systematically poisoning high mountain lakes and restocking them with genetically pure trout.
We've been able to protect, really on an ecosystem basis, the whole South Fork, and that's pretty exciting to be able to do something at that scale.
Expanding fishing opportunities has been one of the brighter aspects of Vacherot's job. He lists Hooked on Fishing, Becoming an Outdoors Woman, and Casting for Recovery as great programs that work on getting kids fishing, teaching women outdoor skills, and breast cancer survivors to fly fish.
Fishing, to me, is something that everybody can do at some level. It's a great family sport, something you can do your entire life.
Vacherot's successor will be stepping into a situation where lake trout management continues to dominate the agenda, reforging an agreement with the tribes, reestablishing native fisheries against threats from illegal introductions and aquatic invasive species, all on waters that many people in northwest Montana are passionate about.
You have to not take it personal. You have to know that they care deeply and that there's some common ground there. I have always said outreach is just critical, and communication. We need to know what fishermen are thinking. We need to be out there talking to the folks. And because they spend so much time on the water, they have insights that we don't get.
Vacherot says he intends to stay connected with these issues. In the future, he'll just be on the other side of the microphone during public comment. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
The fate of a disputed coyote and wolf derby planned for this weekend in central Idaho will be debated Friday in federal court. U.S. District Magistrate Judge Candy Dale scheduled a telephone hearing in environmental groups' lawsuit for 9:30 a.m. Wild Earth Guardians and other environmental groups contend the U.S. Forest Service ignored federal laws by allowing the competition to proceed this Saturday and Sunday near Salmon without requiring organizers to first secure a special use permit for a commercial event on public land. But the U.S. Forest Service says its rules don't require a special permit. Dale has been asked to issue a temporary restraining order that would halt the event. Event foes branded it a, quote, wolf slaughter, end quote, while its organizers say few of the predators will likely be killed.
Four couples challenging Idaho's gay marriage ban this week asked a federal judge to block the state from intervening in their lawsuit, arguing such a move would unnecessarily add to their workload and complicate the case. They filed their lawsuit in U.S. District Court in November against Governor C.L. Butch Otter of Ada County Clerk Chris Rich, contending Idaho's 2006 voter-backed law banning gay marriage violates the U.S. Constitution's equal protection and due process guarantees. Now, the Idaho couple say allowing Idaho to intervene isn't necessary since Otter is already an adequate representative of its interests. Attorney General Lawrence Wasdin counters Idaho has a strong interest and a right to defend its laws. Idaho's case comes as judge in New Mexico, Ohio, Utah, and Utah ruled in favor of same-sex marriage.
Williston, North Dakota offers a haven for a new working class. Tens of thousands of newcomers have flocked to the capital of the Bakken oil boom over the last decade. The community is flush with high-paying, low-skilled work. It's bringing much in the way of economic development, but not so much in the way of high culture. A recent series of writers' workshops is trying to change that. This month, we've been bringing you a series of stories on the side effects of the Bakken. Capital reporter Dan Boyce tells us more about trying to bring out the oil boom's creative side.
Driving into Williston at night feels like descending into a bustling industrial assembly line. Roads are dominated by endless lines of trucks pulling in and out of great warehouses. The flares of distant oil rigs paint an orange glow onto the sky, which locals call the North Dakota nightlight. But there are also bastions of bohemia here, if you know where to look.
Dinosaur blood, sulfur, crustaceans.
A small group sits around tables in a shop called Books on Broadway. Hobby writers, comparing their work over freshly brewed coffee.
Pump, jack, dipping down, back up, down, oil.
The North Dakota Humanities Council put together a three-week series of writers' workshops in communities most impacted by the Bakken.
We wondered when we gave you a homework assignment if you were actually going to come back, but there you are.
Iowa State University English professor Deb Marquardt and professional writer Taylor Brorby conduct the workshops. Each consists of two classes, one where the instructors share some writing samples and get everybody thinking of ideas, and a second class the next week has attendees bringing in pieces of their own writing for feedback.
Gate manager is crunching numbers now. We have to take on more fuel.
Subject matter varies widely.
This is a story about Lydia the ladybug who lives in our backyard and her adventures.
And the people here range from longtime Williston residents, yoga instructors, and crop adjusters, to the oil workers making up a large portion of the new population, like Michael Ogden.
I prevent oil rigs from exploding.
He works on the gas flaring systems found on oil rigs. He's originally from Polson and graduated from the University of Montana School of Journalism years ago. He had a busy work day near the South Dakota border and just finished his lyric essay about 20 minutes ago.
It is roughneck work, and if you are skilled enough to crawl past worm status, you might get lucky, but not like Monkey, the man with no thumbs who now grips levers like a lobster since the morning his thumbs were clipped off like butter.
Workshop facilitator Taylor Brorby says these sessions are producing some great writing, challenging his own stereotypes of oil country.
You find that people are willing to share deep sides of their life and what that day-to-day looks like. I don't think we're hearing those stories, and so this serves as a great opportunity to say, not everyone's going to the strip club. Some people are actually writing poems when they're at home or they're working on a short story.
The Bakken is changing. 3 years ago,
attendees say they feel a transformation starting to take hold in Williston, a move from the temporary search for a quick buck to something more.
I've seen a great move towards permanence and quality.
More writing and art can serve as an indicator of that, such as the way of boomtown economies. Facilitator Deb Marquardt.
It brings in the sort of first wave of economic activity, and then it brings other things with it. The gourmet pizza shops come, and the coffee shops come, and then maybe, you know, they'll get more theaters and then more music.
That is, if this boom doesn't have an equally dramatic bust, something Williston has seen before.
We've seen a lot of good work, I think, here tonight.
The writers exchange contact information. They say they plan to meet up more to form a local writers group to try to build a little permanent culture of their own. I'm Dan Boyce, reporting in Williston, North Dakota.
The North Dakota Humanities Council says they will be releasing a selection of pieces from the writers' workshops in a publication due out early next year. The council is also planning more workshops for next fall. You can see and hear all of the pieces from our series on Bakken spinoffs. Just follow the link on our website, mtpr.org.
Federal wildlife officials announced earlier this week that they've crafted a new plan to restore the highly endangered black-footed ferret that includes reintroducing the animal to more states. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service plan calls for boosting their numbers to about 3,000 animals. In this feature interview with Edward O'Brien, Fish and Wildlife Service Blackfooted Ferret Recovery Coordinator Pete Gober says a key element of this plan is to make it as non-threatening as possible to draw in more partners. Gober says the prairie dog-eating member of the weasel family was thought to be extinct until 1981 when a rancher found a solitary enclave of the animals in northwest Wyoming. It's proven to be a difficult job to restore the animals.
They succumb to disease, likely a combination of both distemper and sylvatic plague. The last animals were removed from that population. The last remaining animals were salvaged in 1986 and 1987. They came into a captive breeding facility operated by the Wyoming Game and Fish Department. And Wyoming Game and Fish got us started with breeding of black-footed ferrets. And the Fish and Wildlife Service in the 90s took over that operation and moved it to northeastern Colorado. We captive breed ferrets in conjunction with a number of zoos across the country, including the Phoenix, Colorado Springs, Louisville National Zoo, and Toronto Zoo. And the animals that are produced through those efforts are released into the wild or used to replace animals that are aging in the captive population.
And that's a tricky proposition, repopulating these wild groups, if you will. Why is it so tough?
Well, there's a reason the ferrets are endangered. They've been the victim of reduction in prairie dog numbers across the West. We probably only have about 2% of the prairie dogs we had historically. They probably would have been fine even at that, because there still are quite a few prairie dogs left, and they've recovered from a low point in the 1970s. But they've also been impacted by poisoning efforts to reduce prairie dogs that compete with livestock operations. And probably most devastating, the prairie dogs and ferrets both are vulnerable to sylvatic plague, which is a non-native disease that's only been in this country for a little over a century. And when plague hits a prairie dog colony, it not only kills off the prairie dogs, which is the ferret's primary food source and on which it relies for shelter in the prairie dog burrows, but it also kills the ferrets directly.
So as prairie dogs go, so goes the black-footed ferret.
Yes.
Yeah, this sylvatic plague, I don't mean to go too deep in the rabbit hole here, but what is it? Why is it so fatal for these guys?
Well, it's an old world disease, and the evolutionary history of species that evolved in North America, much like Native Americans, were vulnerable to European diseases. Ferrets and prairie dogs did not evolve to deal with plague.
What is the black-footed ferret population now, ballpark, in North America?
We have about 300 black-footed ferrets in captive breeding facilities. We maintain that population by replacing older animals with younger animals, and we release about 200 animals every year out to different sites in the West. We've put ferrets out at 21 different sites in 8 states, Mexico and Canada, for over 2 decades now, or close to 2 decades. And we have about 500 adult animals scattered across the West. We've had a few more in the past, but recent drought and plague impacts have reduced the numbers somewhat.
So drought's an issue as well?
Drought is an issue because if prairie dogs don't do well and don't have young of the year, ferrets have a hard time feeding their own young because those smaller prairie dog pups are considerably more vulnerable than the adults. A ferret is about the same size as a prairie dog. It does have the advantage of hunting prairie dogs when they're asleep at night, since the ferret's nocturnal.
So we're here to talk about the final revised recovery plan for the black-footed ferret. What is the objective of this plan, and what does recovery in this case mean?
Well, given the threats that ferrets and prairie dogs face across the West, and we're trying to maintain a stable enough prairie dog population to where ferrets don't go through some low point and not make it themselves, we're trying to get 3,000 adult ferrets on the landscape, scattered across the 12 states where they historically occurred. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is it's a risk management strategy of not putting all your eggs in one basket, but also engages a lot of different partners who may have different levels of resource support from year to year to year. And I think the picture of ferret recovery in the future will not be static. We won't save ferrets in one place necessarily and have them there forever. We'll probably have ferrets, so to speak, like lights blinking on and off on a Christmas tree. At any given point in time, we hope to have a collective number to reach our recovery goals, but we've got to realize we're going to lose some populations from time to time due to drought and plague, and they will recover later on with supplementation from additional reintroduction efforts as we go forward in time.
Is there one single most important element of this plan?
I think the major thrust of the recovery plan as we've devised it is to make it non-threatening in terms of engaging additional partners. If we have purposeful prairie dog management and ferret management of only a small portion of what existed historically, this species can be recovered. But it can be threatening from a regulatory standpoint. The goals that we have are not mandatory and are not going to force anyone to do anything. We realize that if we don't have folks working together over the long term, we're not going to have the species out there.
That's a fine line you're treading there.
It is.
Who came together to develop this plan?
The Blackfooted Ferret Recovery Team has been involved with the development of this plan. It's a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service product. But we have state game and fish departments, federal agencies, a number of tribes, and quite a few non-government organizations. Principal among those are folks like Wyoming Game and Fish who've been involved from the get-go. But there are ferrets in eight different states, and those efforts would not have gone forward without the support of the state game and fish departments. And we have ferrets on six different tribal properties across the West as well, so the tribes have really pitched in as far as making a major contribution.
This question is kind of an existential one. Why are we going through all the trouble to protect this critter?
Well, I guess the most direct answer to that is that it's our job. Endangered Species Act directs Fish and Wildlife Service to try to conserve and recover endangered species. As far as the philosophical answer to that, it's part of the American West, and if you can conserve prairie dog populations, at least some prairie dog populations, by conserving black-footed ferrets in conjunction with them, then you'll conserve a number of other species that rely on that diversity in the prairie landscape, like mountain plover and burrowing owls and golden eagles and fringeless hawks, etc.
I've taken a big chunk of your time. One last question, and that is this final revised recovery plan, what does that mean? Where are we in the process, and what's next?
The recovery plan indicates that we're about 15% of the way toward our delisting goal of putting this species back in the hands of state game and fish departments to manage. We've got a long ways to go, but this is a sort of species that could take off fairly rapidly if we have techniques that will allow prairie dogs to persist on the landscape. Every place we've put ferrets out, except for one, over these many years, we've had young produced in the spring. It's a pretty simple equation. If you add ferrets to prairie dogs, you'll have an endangered species success story if you can keep them managed on the landscape.
Out of curiosity, what was the one that did not work?
SB Ranch in Arizona. We had a plague epizootic slip in during the winter when no one expected it, and despite the animals that were released in the fall, we did not document any young in the spring.
I've been speaking with Blackfooted Recovery Coordinator for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Peter Gobert. Thank you very much. Happy holidays to you, sir.
Happy holidays.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be partly cloudy with some patchy freezing fog and lows 14 to 21 degrees. Tomorrow, look for partly cloudy skies and some areas of freezing fog in the morning with highs in the mid-30s to lower 40s. In central Montana, there is a high wind warning in effect until 5 a.m. Saturday for the Rocky Mountain Front, as well as Eastern Glacier, Toole, and Liberty counties. Tonight should be mostly cloudy, becoming partly cloudy with lows 25 to 40 degrees. Southwest wind gusts could reach up to 70 miles per hour. Tomorrow calls for partly cloudy skies with highs 45 to 55 degrees. Expect southwest wind gusts up to 55 miles per hour. And in southwest Montana tonight, it should be partly cloudy with lows 15 to 30 degrees. Tomorrow, look for sunny skies with highs 35 to 45 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Dave Ditloff.
The end of the year is fast approaching. For many of us, this season is a time to reflect on our lives and appreciate the good things in them. I'm sure that many of us gave thanks for the good food we ate yesterday and for the natural beauty of the place we live in. Montana is truly blessed. Our agricultural sector is thriving, and our great outdoors is unmatched. Farming and ranching contributes more than $2 billion to the state annually, and hunting, fishing, and wildlife viewing brings in more than $1.4 billion in revenue each year. In the next month, Congress will likely act on a major piece of legislation that will impact both conservation and our agricultural sector, the Farm Bill. A conference committee of House members and senators, including Montana Senator Max Baucus, has been meeting in recent weeks to hash out the differences between the House-passed version of the Farm Bill and the Senate one. The discussions have garnered a little bit of news. The funding levels of the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, more often called food stamps, have gotten the bulk of the media attention. The shift away from direct payments to farmers to crop insurance subsidies has gotten a little too. One thing that hasn't gotten much attention to date is the conservation title in the Farm Bill. That's a shame. The conservation programs in the Farm Bill are arguably the most important set of private lands conservation policies in federal statute. There are many important conservation programs proposed in the Farm Bill, but two deserve special mention: Sod Saver and Conservation Compliance. A national Sod Saver provision is vital to conserving the remaining native grasslands across Montana and the country. Such a national Sod Saver provision would lower the federal crop insurance subsidy given to a farmer by the federal government when that farmer plows under native prairie to grow row crops. It is much needed. Native prairie is being lost at an alarming rate. Between 2011 and 2012, more than 10,000 acres of prairie were converted to croplands in Montana. This trend could forever change the appearance and ecological health of the state. Most of the intact prairie being converted is marginal cropland, highly erodible and or prone to flooding. On the flip side, these lands often provide quality wildlife habitat, flood mitigation, erosion control, and prime livestock grazing range. Under a national Sod Saver provision, farmers could still break out native grasslands to plant row crops. That is a right that comes with the ownership of private property. But there should be a limit to how much taxpayers should have to subsidize the practice. In a time of tight federal budgets, this not only makes good sense from a conservation standpoint, it also makes fiscal sense. As a nation, we shouldn't be subsidizing the breaking out of important grasslands for marginal crop production. Research has shown that crop insurance subsidies on these high-risk fields are a factor leading to grassland conversion. With crop fare rates on recently converted lands often twice the national average, crop insurance payouts occur twice as often. All in all, it is estimated that by reducing the insurance subsidy on crops grown on recently broken out grasslands, a national Sod Saver provision would save taxpayers an estimated $16 million per year. In addition to passing a national Sod Saver provision, Congress needs to link conservation compliance to crop insurance subsidies. Conservation compliance prevents farmers who drain wetlands or those who farm highly erodible lands without a conservation plan from qualifying for certain Farm Bill subsidies. In recent years, conservation compliance has been needed for a farmer to get direct payments, but not crop insurance subsidies. This hasn't been that big of a problem because most farmers have received direct payments and therefore have been subject to conservation compliance. But this new Farm Bill will likely change all that. Both the House-passed and the Senate-passed Farm Bill drastically cut direct payments to farmers and use that savings to bolster crop insurance subsidies. This means that the number of farms subject to conservation compliance would drastically decrease, unless it is linked to crop insurance subsidies. From a conservation perspective, linking them together is vitally important. Without conservation compliance, the USDA estimates that 5.6 to 10.9 million acres of highly erodible lands and 1.5 to 3.3 million acres of wetlands that are currently not being farmed could be placed into production. As a result, millions of tons of topsoil will be blown away, and the habitat, water quality, and other ecological benefits of hundreds of thousands of acres of wetlands would be lost. To top it off, taxpayers would be helping foot the bill of these environmental losses. To prevent this, the Farm Bill Conference Committee must link conservation compliance to crop insurance subsidies. They also should pass a national Sod Saver provision. Both policies make for good conservation and sound fiscal sense. Passage of a farm bill with both provisions would be a good way for Congress to start out the new year. This is Dave Ditloff, Regional Representative for the National Wildlife Federation. Happy holidays.
Dave Ditloff is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. Views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.